Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why some physicians are concerned about health insurers using AI to deny claims.
And the rise, fall, and redemption of Jell-O.
But first, a key funding source for public schools in Arizona could be going away unless lawmakers can agree on a new deal that they can ask voters to approve. The measure, known as Prop 123, increased the distribution from the state land trust to provide more money to K-12 schools in the state. Voters narrowly approved it in 2016. But it's set to expire next year, and if it's going to continue, legislators need to come up with a new plan to send to voters. That has proven to be a challenge, and a new provision introduced by Republicans would seem to make it even more so. With me now to talk about this is KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke from the Politics Desk. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So, as I mentioned, voters very narrowly approved this about a decade ago, and now it's up for renewal. That's pretty much why we're here, right?
Yeah, and we've talked about this before. As you mentioned, the next fiscal year it runs out, so that's at the end of June. And lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, Governor Katie Hobbs has been involved for over a year trying to hash out exactly what this would look like. It, like you said, it boosts the percent they get from the state land trust fund. So they've been hashing out where should that percentage be at, what it should be used for, and all of those things. But now we've got a new bombshell added to the mix.
Right. Well, and sort of in the good old days, as it were, meaning like last year, the real debate was, as you say, what percentage should come out, and should the money just go to teacher salary? Should it also maybe go to support staff, you know, bus drivers, nurses, speech therapists, folks like that? That is no longer just the only obstacle.
No, even as early as this year, like, we were still kind of talking about that. The governor had her proposal. Republicans in the legislature had their proposal. They seem to be getting closer together. But now Republicans also want to tie a voucher, school voucher protections in there. As you know, we already have expansive school vouchers in the state, but it's in state law, not the Constitution. Now they want to send this to voters to add those protections to the Constitution. We don't know exactly what those protections would look like yet, but broadly, if there's protections in the state Constitution, it's really tough to change something.
So why are Republicans pulling this out now?
It's hard to say exactly why, but it seems like, you know, they're hedging against any potential future changes to the legislature where Democrats may take over. Democrats have long spoken about their desire to roll back the universal voucher expansion. Now, if this gets sent to voters and voters approve it and there's these protections in the Constitution, that takes it out of the legislature's hands. Essentially, once something's in the Constitution, voter protected, it really can only be changed by voters taking it back out.
So I would imagine that Governor Hobbs, legislative Democrats, maybe some probably not maybe, many in the education community, not a real big fan of this idea.
No, Governor Katie Hobbs called it a non-starter, though it should be noted they don't actually need her on this. You can send it to the ballot without the governor. But legislative Democrats and the two big education groups who fought for Prop 123, Save Our Schools and the Arizona Education Association, the teachers union, have all come out and said, no, this is, you know, any proposal that ties Prop 123 to vouchers, we're going to stand firmly opposed.
On a practical matter, at least at this stage, the legislature and Republicans just need Republicans to support it, right, to get it onto the ballot. Does it seem as though the GOP is unified around this idea?
Yeah, it's not often we say the GOP caucus is unified on something, but voucher protections generally is something that all factions of the party can get behind, and they usually do coalesce around issues when it comes to protecting those. So I definitely think that barring some sort of breakthrough in negotiations, that this looks like something that will get referred to voters.
Does it seem as though there are ongoing talks where Democrats, maybe the governor, are able to give something else to get the voucher provision out? Or is this sort of the plan that the legislature looks like it's going to send to voters?
As far as I've heard, you know, I think Senator Priya Sundaresan, who's the Senate minority leader, lead Democrat in the Senate, said that, like, the negotiations had kind of stagnated. And then all of a sudden they hear this proposal with the vouchers coming out. So it sounds like Republicans started moving kind of in their own lane on this one. Democrats were no longer involved in that conversation until the Republicans were ready to show this off. And so it doesn't look like there's any track towards a negotiated peace, as it were, out of this thing.
It's interesting because, as I mentioned, in 2016, the measure barely passed. I mean, it was 50% and a little bit. It was not approved overwhelmingly by voters. And that had then Governor Ducey, it had legislators on both sides of the aisle, the education groups all in favor of it. It still barely passed. I would imagine the conventional wisdom would be if there's not that unified support sort of at the elected and policy level, maybe that hurts it somewhat?
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely a gambit on the Republicans' part. I think they were kind of rolling the dice saying, hey, as long as we're tying this Prop 123 funding, these education groups, the Democrats, they don't want to see that go away. So maybe we can force them to swallow this pill that they don't really like as long as we're tying it to something they do. It appears that that's not going to work out, and it really could threaten because the teachers' union, the Save Our Schools, they were huge parts of this coalition to get this thing passed along with Democrats. And yeah, if you don't have them on board, if the margin is slim like last time, then it really puts the future of this thing at risk.
Might those other groups try to do their own thing, collect signatures and refer something of their own to the ballot, maybe just a clean renewal?
Yeah, I mean, the head of the AEA, the teachers' union, said they're not ruling anything out. So I asked around a little bit. I haven't heard of any plans yet, but again, she said they're exploring all possibilities. So I'm guessing that's one of those possibilities they're taking a look at.
Right. And we should probably note that the legislature would sort of be on the hook, at least for some amount of time, right, to backfill this money if there's no renewal.
Yeah. When they originally passed it, they put in a provision. Essentially, the legislature has to backfill from the general fund, which is the fund most state services are paid out of, around $300 million to make up most of that money that would be lost. So no one's worrying about a fiscal cliff with this expiring because this wouldn't go to the ballot till 2026 at this point, likely anyway. But again, when you're pulling from the general fund, that means there's other stuff that gets paid for from the general fund that isn't going to get those dollars. So will the school budget suffer in the immediate short term? No, but you're going to have other priorities that are going to take a backseat.
Right. All right. Lots to follow. KJZZ's Wayne Shusky from the Politics Desk. Thanks, Wayne.
Thank you.
A recent Newsweek piece painted a dire picture of the housing market in Phoenix, with a housing inventory in the metro area at its highest levels in about a decade. The article quoted the CEO of a real estate app warning of a potential crash. But is elevated inventory really such a bad thing? Are we in the midst of a sell-off by anxious property owners, or is there something more nuanced going on? For some analysis of the situation, we are joined now by Tina Tambor, senior housing analyst at the Cromford Report. Good morning, Tina.
Good morning.
So, Tina, as I was just mentioning, last week it was reported that the Arizona housing market has a current inventory of about 30,000 homes, with about 22,000 of those here in Phoenix. Those are the highest availability numbers since, I believe, November of 2016. What do you make of these numbers?
Well, I can tell you that we were not crashing in 2016, so doesn't necessarily mean that our values were going to crash. In fact, in 2016, our values were rising. It was a seller's market. So what we're seeing right now is I would say we're at kind of a level that has been stable for the last 3 years in terms of demand, kind of waiting for those mortgage rates to help ease up some of the suppression under 500,000 and those price points. But we've had a very exuberant luxury market, specifically between 2024 and 25. So that's been kind of keeping our prices elevated in our measures, as we were a little bit top heavy in our data sets.
Okay.
But more recently, though, what we've seen is with the stock market fluctuations and some volatility and uncertainty, some of the luxury buyers have taken a pause, just, you know, letting it slide for a little bit, seeing whether or not we're going to get more certainty. And at the same time, we saw a boost in our sales under 500,000. So what we saw is an actual market share shift in our data set where we got a little bottom heavy and it pulled our averages down. And so I could see from the surface that it would look like prices are collapsing, when in fact, very few of these by price range are you seeing any, you know, dramatic drops.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, what do you make of this allegation that there's a sell-off happening because of anxiety about the U.S. economy? Do you see any evidence of that?
No, not necessarily. What I see is people having to make decisions, whether they're investors or second homeowners. We've got about 40% of our supply was purchased either as a rental or a second home. We had a kind of a rough short-term rental market this last spring, as As the U.S. dollar got strong, it became more expensive for our most popular tourists from Canada to come here. So that was definitely a drawback, in addition to some, you know, unease about the discourse between our countries. There was a little bit of apprehension to come here. But I would say that we had kind of a rough spring for short-term rentals that has put some of them on the market. And that's a good thing because they're often in very good shape and come with fun things like toys and you know, furniture and things like that. But we also have, you know, the second home market. When you have the exchange rate between Canada and the U.S. became very, very positive for sellers from Canada. So we did see a bump up in listings from Canadians as well.
So let's contextualize these fluctuations a little bit. Nick Gurley, who's the CEO of ReVenture App, which is the real estate platform that I was mentioning in the setup here, his allegation in the piece is that the market is trending down, quote, and trending down fast. What that means in practical terms is a roughly 7% drop in home prices since their peak in June of 2022. But a lot of this was the peak of those prices was pandemic related, right?
The peak of those prices were really fueled by flip investing. So when you have a lot of Wall Street investment coming in, and you remember the large flip corporations like Opendoor and Offerpad and Zillow, they were all buying and selling amongst each other, even as affordability became out of reach for the general population. So what ended up happening was they hit a peak in 2022, and then the mortgage rates started to rise, and they didn't have anybody to sell those properties to as Wall Street pulled out. And some of these investors got stuck with these properties that they had overpaid for. So that's when we saw losses from 2022 in June all the way to December. In that six-month period, we dropped about 13% in our prices, our price measures. But we bounced in 2023, and we have been pretty flat for 3 years. We haven't seen any big, bold movements in price. What we've been seeing is the cost to the seller going up as we move into a weaker seller market. And now we've been in a buyer's market now for about 6 to 7 months. And it takes a long time for prices to actually respond to a buyer's market. You have to be in a buyer's market for longer than a season. So what we're seeing is now a weakening in price that is a result of a long-term seller's buyer's market that has kind of gotten to the point where sellers have already accepted that they're going to come in at a reasonable price. They've accepted they're going to do repairs. They've accepted that they're going to pay for closing costs and rate buy-downs and things like that. And now the buyers are just shaving a little more off the top. When we look at the price points by price range, year-over-year changes are under 2%. And many times they're really close to flat to where they were this time last year. Like I said, this is more of a market share shift as the luxury market pulled out due to volatility of the stock market. And that gave the under 500,000 market more market share, and it pulled our averages and our medians down, and it makes it look like there's a, you know, a massive drop off when really it's not that exciting.
Okay. Well, not that exciting. Potentially welcome news for market observers. Thank you very much, Tina. Tina Tambor is Senior Housing Analyst at the Cromford Report. Tina, appreciate your input.
My pleasure.
And a development from Rome, white smoke has appeared over the Sistine Chapel, signaling the election of a new pope. A name has not yet been announced. We're told the new pope will appear on a balcony soon. We will, of course, keep you posted as developments take place. And you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a couple years ago, a near-censorship controversy at Mesa Arts Center made headlines. Why the artist at the heart of it all returned to paint a mural on the outside of the building.
But first, state lawmakers have approved and sent to the governor a bill that would generally preclude health insurance companies from relying on artificial intelligence to decide whether to deny a claim. The measure had near unanimous support in both the state House and Senate and would require a medical director to individually review any denials. The bill had the support of, among others, the Arizona Medical Association. With me to talk about it is Dr. Michael Dunn, a board member of the group and a family physician working in urgent care in the East Valley. And Dr. Dunn, how prevalent is it that insurance companies are using AI in decision-making, at least based on your experience?
Yes. Well, over the last few years, it has actually become a lot more prevalent. The insurance companies, for the most part, are denying that they're doing this. But we know that, through various court actions that are taking place, that they are, in fact, doing it. I know in my own practice, we are seeing a market increase in the number of denials and downcoding denials that we are getting in our billing, and it has the fingerprints of AI all over it, mainly because the denials just don't make any sense, and they're wrong most of the time.
When you say the denials don't make sense and they're wrong, is that a matter of opinion, or is it like sort of a poorly written ChatGPT essay?
You know, it's a combination of both, actually. There is some subjectiveness in the billing process. And that is part of the problem. But that subjectiveness, it works on both ways. Physicians could potentially overbill. But what we actually see more of are the insurance companies underpaying, for the services that, that we're billing for. And then the other part of that is that when they either deny a claim or downcode a claim, they're supposed to give you a reason for it. And usually it's just about a half a sentence why they are doing it. And that blurb makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, we look at the guidelines and, the billing and the documentation that we've submitted, and they just don't make any sense. And that's where we believe that, that AI is the culprit behind, these problems that we're having, because we didn't see it like that before. You could always tell that there was a human behind it and there was, some thought behind it. That didn't mean we agreed with it, but you could see that they were trying to make a case for their position.
So are you seeing more decisions with which you disagree now than you did before? Because I think, if you talk to a lot of physicians, you talk to a lot of patients, it's not like they always agreed with the decisions to approve or deny, especially deny, claims that insurance companies were making, before.
Sure. Yes, I would say that we're definitely seeing more denials. And, in my own practice, we're kind of on the low end of the totem pole in terms of reimbursements. Obviously the surgical specialties, where their billing is much higher than ours would be. They're seeing that on a much grander scale. We see it, and we lose $15 or $20. When they see it, they might lose thousands of dollars on a case. And it definitely is more prevalent than it has been in times past.
How might this impact how doctors like you do your jobs and treat your patients if insurance companies are using AI to determine whether or not a particular claim is going to be approved or not?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's we're a business, and to keep our business moving forward and staying healthy, we have to get paid. We've got lots of overhead that seems to go up every year, and staff members that need to get paid, and they would like raises. For the most part, insurance reimbursements have been stagnant for the last 20 years, and in some cases they're lower than they were 20 years ago. I don't think the general public recognizes that, but as a physician, with single digit profit margins, it just doesn't take much or too many claims being denied that were in the red.
And presumably that would make you think a little bit maybe more differently about how you treat your patients, maybe tests that you order or diagnoses that you give them. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, absolutely. It all goes into it. I mean, certainly, in the last few years, a new technology, new to us anyway, in our practices is PCR testing, mm-hmm. And we can now do that in the office versus sending it out to the labs. And but it's expensive technology, and there are much better tests. Yet now the insurance companies are starting to see these claims come in from, you know, private practice offices, and now their expense is going up. Well, now we're starting to see them deny those or reduce the reimbursements on them. And so it does make us think twice. You know, do we want to innovate? Do we want to have these new modalities in our office that are expensive to us, but we may not get paid for?
Do you think that there is any role for AI in this space with health insurance companies and maybe even an initial screening of denying versus accepting a claim? Like, do you see any place for AI here?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, this bill, HB 2175, does not keep the insurance companies from using AI. And between you and me, I think they'd be crazy for not using it as a screening tool, as you suggested. But they need to be accountable to their to the patients, and the AI cannot be the end all be all. A human, preferably a human that is experienced in the area of, you know, where they're making the denial, you know, needs to review the case and make that final determination. And that's in fact what HB 2175 does, is it holds the insurance companies accountable and make sure that somebody reviews the case prior to a denial, or you know, either a denial of a claim or a prior authorization goes into effect.
So maybe the kind of thing where the AI does sort of an initial screening, it separates into the yeses and the noes, and then a human goes through and looks at the noes and says, okay, these really should be denied. These maybe we can let through.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense from a business standpoint. AI has a lot of potential. It has potential in my office as well. It can really alleviate some of those administrative burdens that we have. And in fact, we've you know, I've started using it as, you know, as a business owner of my practice. It's been useful, but I can't 100% depend on it. I have to look at the work that's been generated and make sure that I agree with it and refine it. But it does make my life a lot easier. And I think it will only get better with time.
All right. That is Dr. Michael Dunn, a family physician in the East Valley. Dr. Dunn, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. So, you've heard of the Bible Belt, but what about the Jell-O Belt? Christy Spackman first heard that phrase when she was a kid, and it stuck with her for decades. As an adult, she went to culinary school and eventually got a PhD in food studies. But even after all that, she still wasn't sure when or exactly why people started referring to this particular region of the West, northern Arizona, Utah, parts of surrounding states, as the Jell-O Belt. So, thanks to a recent grant from the Red Center at BYU, she has launched an ongoing project, a deep dive into the cultural history of Jell-O that she calls Tightening the Jell-O Belt: Food, Faith, and Dietary Friction in the Intermountain West. Earlier this week, I spoke to her about the origins of her fascination with this colorful food and its colorful history.
When I was a kid, my grandmother would always have these crazy Jell-O concoctions. Her favorite one was some combination of cottage cheese, green Jell-O, and pistachio pudding with some nuts in it. And it sounds weird, but it was also delicious. Mm-hmm. And so as I got older and became a little bit more aware of some of the culinary snobberies that exist in the world, I came to learn that thing that I thought was delicious was also kind of lowbrow.
Mm. Well, help us kind of trace the brow level of Jell-O, because as I understand it, it's been a real roller coaster ride.
That is a really accurate description. So gelatin as a substance has actually been highly prized by chefs for a long time. It's hard to make. You have to boil bones for a long time. Getting something that's clear requires a lot of work. So high-end French cuisine, you have aspic, so that jelly-like stuff that's often on top of a pâté. And so up until the late 1800s, making a gelatin, one, it was often savory, but two, it was really hard to do. And in the late 1800s, you get a researcher who figures out a way to make more or less instant gelatin. And then General Foods kind of draws on that and starts adding flavorings to it. And you get these sweet-based gelatin desserts that become named Jell-O. And that actually is a major part of early 20th century culinary culture in the U.S.
So there was a time, right, where these Jell-O dessert creations, like the one you were talking about from your own childhood, that was like a considered a flashy thing to serve at a dinner party, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't considered lowbrow. It was sort of a mark of domestic endeavor.
Yes. Laura Shapiro has this great book out there called Perfection Salad for anyone who wants to read up on this idea. And the original Perfection Salad, if I remember correctly, was a cabbage salad suspended in gelatin made in a mold. And so that's a lot of work to do that well.
So how did Jell-O lose that sense of flair or pride?
So food historians suggest that a lot of what changed was just the fact that you had this massive shift in culinary culture all around. So the 1950s and 1960s and the post-war boom where women start really re-entering the workforce, there's just a shift in how people cook. And part of that shift is facilitated by the food industry itself, which gets really excited about, hey, we're going to cook for you. We're going to do things like make cake mixes. Mm-hmm. And so there are these trends where culinary things that start out being really fancy, I mean, we all want a part of that.
So am I tracking this correctly, that the way that Jell-O starts to be seen as less highbrow than it was in like the 40s and 50s is that it's like a little too easy?
I think that's part of it. I think also it's not necessarily highbrow in the 40s and 50s. It's midbrow.
It's midbrow. Okay.
And there's something about the middle class that is both a really powerful thing where many people wish to be part of the crowd, but also a thing that, especially with the countercultural movement in the 1970s, where there's this whole emergence of what some food historians have called the brown food movement, like mm-hmm. whole wheat bread, other things. And foods like Jell-O are just seen as not fitting that more healthful approach that eventually comes to dominate with diet culture in the 1980s and early 1990s.
As I understand it, because of a lot of these factors, there is a period where Jell-O is sort of on the wane, mm-hmm. right? And then it ends up making a comeback. What prompts that comeback?
Part of what prompts the comeback is General Foods gets really upset about their declining sales, and they task a marketing manager with overcoming it. And he and his team come up with this idea of jigglers. And it is amazing
to me Jell-O jigglers.
How successful Jell-O jigglers were.
We're definitely going to see if we can find an old Jell-O jigglers commercial to play right here.
We're here to celebrate a different way to eat Jell-O gelatin. With our bare hands, all we need, cookie cutters, this easy recipe, and we've got jigglers!
And then they bring Bill Cosby on as their spokesperson. So this is before Cosby has had his Me Too moment. But so you get this association of fun, family friendly. It's definitely something that, at least for folks living in Utah and along the Jell-O Belt, as we are going to call it, who have a lot of kids, that this is something that is an easy dessert to make with your children. You could consider it maybe relatively healthy, or at least it's low fat. And in the 1980s and 90s, that is the low fat craze moment. There's the tension, however, that this is the same time when fraternities and sororities are getting really into Jell-O wrestling contests and Jell-O shots.
Right.
So,
boy, that's a real tension.
It is a real tension.
Finger food for your kids to shake while they eat and fraternities and sororities.
Yeah.
So is this the moment where this idea of the Jell-O Belt emerges, or was the idea of the Jell-O Belt pre-existing and the meaning of it just sort of changed?
It's really post-88 that this association of Utah with Jell-O starts to emerge. And I do think some of that is related to the way that Jell-O shows up at community gatherings. Mm-hmm. And in 2001, Jell-O becomes the official state snack of the state of Utah.
Wow.
And that is, I think, the moment when it that relationship between Utah specifically and then members of the faith most commonly associated with Utah more generally, so members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, start getting this overlay of folks from Utah eat Jell-O.
One other thing with Jell-O I want to make sure we don't go past is you mentioned your grandmother, if I'm not mistaken, housewives presenting Jell-O creations in the middle of the 20th century as kind of the capstone to an evening. I have the sense that there is a somewhat gendered relationship with Jell-O. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Historically, the gendered relationship with Jell-O was that male chefs working for very rich people made Jell-O, except it wasn't called Jell-O. They made gelatins, they made aspics. And it is in the 20th century, with the invention of Jell-O, that it moves from being in the professional kitchen into the home kitchen. And when you make that transition, especially in the U.S., that is a transition that often moves it into a feminine space. And culinary historians and other folks have pointed out that once you move something from this masculine space into the feminine space, it also loses some of its cultural cachet. There is this really strong association when people talk about Jell-O in Utah to use it as a slur almost. So it's this moment of taking a food and mobilizing all of the food's connotations with childhood or with femininity to describe an entire people.
Well, I've been speaking to Christy Spackman, who is an associate professor for the School for the Future of Innovation in Society at ASU and a recipient of a 2025 Red Center for Western Studies Award for her project, Tightening the Jell-O Belt, Food, Faith, and Dietary Friction in the Intermountain West. Christy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There is a new mural on the outside of Mesa Art Center, and the artist behind it was recently part of a controversy surrounding an exhibit inside the gallery. LA-based artist and activist Shepard Ferry says his piece, called Interdependent Nature, expresses two somewhat overlapping messages, one around environmental responsibility, the other about peace. But in 2023, the opening of an exhibit of Ferry's work at Mesa Art Center was delayed by a month. A city official wanted one of the pieces in the show removed over fears it'd be controversial with police. The print was ultimately allowed to stay, but the center's former chief curator filed a lawsuit against the city, in part over allegations of censorship and violations of First Amendment rights. I spoke with Shepard Ferry recently about all this, and we started with his thinking behind doing the mural at Mesa Art Center and what appealed to him about the project.
Well, I love doing large-scale public works because it allows my art to engage with a public that doesn't necessarily go into a place like the Mesa Art Center or a gallery or any other museum. Those places are sometimes intimidating for people who don't have an art background or strong art knowledge. So I think that the opportunity to communicate with people is really valuable on that scale. Then also, because I had been included in a significant show at the Mesa Art Center, there was a connection into what I call my inside-outside philosophy, which means that I like to work outside the system. I've done a lot of street art that wasn't legal. I've done a lot of things that were self-produced DIY things, but I also work with institutions and corporations to infiltrate the system. And this sort of shows the multiple dimensions of that approach, considering also that my work was almost removed from that show at the Mesa Art Center, yet the Mesa Art Center staff, as well as a lot of the public and my fellow artists that were in the show, stood up for keeping my work in the show. It's a bit of a triumph, I think, that my work is now adorning the exterior of the space, even though they were allies the whole time. But due to some friction with the police, there was a controversy there. And I'm a big believer that art can stir up really difficult conversations, but it can also get people talking. And I think it functioned that way in this. So it's symbolic of my entire thought process behind my work and what I'm hoping it can achieve.
Was there ever any thought in your mind, given what happened during that exhibition, to not doing the mural?
Well, my thought was, if I'm able to do with the mural what I believe in, which is to, you know, make imagery that has my point of view without being outright censored, then I still want to do it. I don't think that being offended by disagreement and then deciding to be uncooperative or being paralyzed by that, I don't think that helps anything ever in any situation in the world. So I certainly didn't want to be part of a mindset that I'm trying to encourage people to avoid on my own part.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, like, it seems like it would have been easy to either say, yeah, no, I'm good, you know, based on our history, or to say, okay, I'll do it, and then not literally, of course, but sort of figuratively paint a middle finger, as it were, as part of the mural. It seems like you chose neither of those things.
Yeah, you're right. I wanted to work with the Art Center knowing that they have a lot of pressure to make sure that the community best interest is taken into account. And believe it or not, for having been somewhat of a provocateur throughout my career, the community best interest is exactly why I do everything I do. I sometimes think that that means that you have to shake people up a little bit, but other times I think that finding common ground is important. And with this mural, I was able to find common ground with the Mesa Arts Center and the city, where I was able to convey what I wanted, and they were happy. Mesa has a climate action plan. There is an interest in making sure that the natural environment is considered, that you know, the future for people and the consequences of climate change are taken into consideration. That's a big theme for me. So that was some easy common ground for us to find. You know, there was one small alteration to the mural that I made that they requested, which I had a factory with this ominous black smoke in one of the geometric compartments of the mural, and they said that felt very negative in the midst of something that mostly felt very positive, and they'd prefer if it wasn't there. And that was a compromise I could make, even though I felt that the contrast between the positive and the ominous factory made what's at stake even more compelling. I still think that the mural is conveying what I want and powerful as it stands.
So you described yourself as an artist and an activist, and I wonder, what to you right now, like, how would you describe the state of activist art or protest art? Like, where is it right now?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's as robust as it was in 2016, 2017, right after Trump was elected the first time. I think that people maybe are regrouping, because a lot of the things that we thought were shattering norms that a piece of art could push back against have now become the norm. So in a way, the antidotes aren't obvious. And I'm feeling that. I know a lot of other artists I've talked to are feeling that. I can't speak for the state of activist art in a complete sense, because sure, I don't know everything that's out there. But what I do believe is that the kind of art that is meant to push back using some of the same rhetoric and anger and I guess very short-lived ideas that is the way that the people I'd consider the oppressors are communicating, I don't think that's the solution. So I'm looking always at ways that, yes, I can point out where there are things that need to be fixed, criticize them, but also point to solutions. And I don't want to amplify the us versus them approach. I'm looking for things that largely we can be united behind.
So has all of that led you to rethink the way that you create art, or maybe the subject matters that you take on, or the way that you try to get across what you're trying to get across?
Not fundamentally. That's if you're talking about how I've shifted since Trump was reelected. I have been evolving my strategies and diversifying my strategies for many years. I've been doing this kind of work for 35 years now. So when I was younger, I was antagonistic because I was just realizing my power to say, I don't agree with everything going on. Then I evolved to want to look at not just criticizing things, but presenting alternative ideas. And, you know, now I really look at just as much how I can seduce people to contemplate something challenging rather than provoking them. So this is something that I consider in a very empathetic way, that even people I disagree with, who in my opinion might be voting against their own interests, are feeling anxious and upset for reasons that one can relate to, but I just don't agree with how they've been manipulated into thinking the certain causes they believe in are legitimate.
All right. That is artist and activist Shepard Fairey. Thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Homelessness is a chronic problem across the valley. One of the many challenges in confronting it is providing health care for people who can't afford it. Last year, I visited Circle the City, an organization whose motto is meet people where they are. Circle the City has medical centers where unhoused people can come get treatment, as well as respite centers where they can recover if they need major surgery. But they also offer a less traditional service, singing.
In a conference room at the Arizona Grand Resort, the Circle the City Choir is rehearsing a song called This Is Me. Many of the choir members are standing up to sing, but some of them can't. They balance their lyric sheets on the arms of their walkers, or cradle them in their laps and keep time by drumming their fingers against their wheelchairs. Between songs, I meet Deb Pina, who tends to close her eyes and sway a little bit when she sings.
I wanted to be like an opera singer when I was like a little girl. I didn't do good in volleyball and all the fun stuff. I wasn't that girl. I just found I had big lungs.
Pina has always known that she has Yaqui tribal heritage. But one day, her daughter encouraged her to take a DNA test. And when the results came back, Pina discovered she also has ancestors from the Chemehuevi people.
The Chemehuevi are singers. That's how they did all their healing, when they did their healing work and their medicine work for the people. It had a lot to do with song.
Healing, Pina says, is a big part of singing with the Circle the City Choir.
The majority of the people are the forgotten, the old, the sick, the people that have mental issues.
What really put me in here recently with being a homeless is being in my car and having neuropathy in the legs and stuff, and then just a big breakout of cellulitis really bad. So
when I came out of the coma that I was in, for 7 days. I couldn't speak and I couldn't walk and couldn't talk, and it broke my heart.
I got burns, which required amputations, which required a 2-year convalescence. And then about a year went by, almost a year and a half, and then I fell into another injury. Because of that injury, I missed a doctor's appointment and my sugars weren't in check. And then the infection just went rampant throughout my body. That's when I lost my leg.
I'm gonna stand up loud, I'm gonna travel about. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. Look out, because here I come.
After I started singing, it started remapping parts of my brain that were blocked. And I found myself, so I found my voice as much as possible. Part of my voice is still, and tongue is still a little paralyzed, so.
I love it. I love being together, hearing all the voices around me, and it lifts your spirits, you know.
Most of the members of the Circle the City Choir are patients at Circle the City, a nonprofit healthcare organization that specializes in treating unhoused people. The choir is the brainchild of Dr. Yvonne Patterson, Circle the City's outpatient medical director.
I saw a choir, I think it was on America's Got Talent, and it was a choir of people who are unhoused from San Diego, and it was beautiful. And I thought, wow, what a great idea. I would really like to do that with our people.
Angela Jarvis is one of Circle the City's nurse practitioners. She treats a lot of the patients in the choir. Part of that treatment, she says, is singing with them.
It's hard being homeless, and it's even harder when you have healthcare issues. And to have something else to focus on other than your situation really can kind of perk up a person and bring them out of depression, which there's a lot of in the homeless community.
One of the things that has been common across the interviews I've done with the patients is a sense of this time in their lives being sort of an interruption of their story.
It is a big interruption in their life from what they saw themselves doing.
The choir is rehearsing at the Arizona Grand today because it's the annual gathering of the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, and Dr. Patterson wants them to perform. The council calls their event a symposium, but as I walk into the convention hall, the atmosphere feels more like a rally.
Homelessness is evil and must be destroyed. Homelessness is evil and must be destroyed.
The choir files into the convention hall. The crowd, many of whom have been waving handbells as they whoop and cheer for the other speakers, goes quiet. The choir's conductor steps to the front of the group and nods to the keyboard player. As the group performs, I watch Deb Pina leaning on her walker. She's got her eyes wide open for the performance, and her voice cuts through the echoey room with a touch of extra clarity, especially on the last line of the first song.
This is me.
The choir sings four songs and leaves the stage to raucous applause. The symposium attendees start ringing their bells and dancing to Pharrell as the Circle the City patients make their way to a row of buses. I catch up with Deb Pina before she climbs on board.
Congratulations on the show.
Thank you.
How did it feel to sing in front of everybody?
Scary. I was a little nervous. I cracked once, but I did pretty good most of the time.
I heard you lifting up a number of the harmonies there.
Yeah, sometimes I have to do that. I don't know, it's just my intuition, and I just know the notes, and I feel it in my soul.
Pina says the experience reminded her of another performance about 20 years ago.
I remember when I was dancing, because I'm a sun dancer, which is our native religion, and I saw the music. I could see something coming out of the drum arbor, and it was colorful, and it was more than energy. It was more like a rainbow, kind of, but not exactly, because you could see a rainbow, and it wasn't that. I don't know if everybody could see it at the time, but I saw the music.
Right now, Deb Pina is healing from a surgery. That's why she has to use the walker. She's hoping to get back to sun dancing when she can. But in the meantime, she'll keep singing with the choir.
It's nice to be heard.
Thanks to all the members of the Circle the City Choir. The other singers whose stories you heard were Joseph Pisch, Theodore Auer, and Kelly Brinley.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.